Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
That's why I say we are engaging in late empire behavior. Mm-hmm. Are we at late empire? I don't know, because the empire hasn't fallen yet. So it's whether or not it falls, right? You know, are you an alcoholic? Who's to say? Are you engaging in alcoholic behavior? If you, you know, drink too much, throw up all over your dashboard and crash your car, I would argue, yes, you are engaging in alcoholic behavior. So I think when we, you know, fight a war for 20 years, that particularly in the last, I don't know, 15 years of it, doesn't really seem to have a purpose that our policymakers can clearly articulate to the American people. And that war is structured around a all-volunteer military, and is funded through deficit spending.
As you all noticed from the title, this is the first time we have ever done a part two of an episode. We were honestly shocked how engaged and riveted everyone was by our conversation with Admiral Stavridis about his book, 2034, a novel of the next world war. Unfortunately, due to the fact that we are interviewing a retired admiral who is incredibly busy, we could only talk with him for roughly 45 minutes. So we wanted to do something special for everyone today, especially given the ramping up of the podcast we're going to talk about in a second. We wanted to feature the second part of the conversation, because what is so cool about 2034 is that the Admiral's co-author, Elliot Ackerman, is actually just as fascinating and just as insightful of a person as he is, so it was great to be able to bring him on. Elliot Ackerman is a former Marine infantry officer. He fought in Fallujah in Iraq during the post invasion of Iraq period. He served in Afghanistan as a special operations officer. He was deeply engaged in efforts to reform the American political system and help independent candidates do better on the presidential ballot. So we get into it a bit later. There's plenty for you all to get excited about. There's so much here, and it was just great to finish the conversation. If I could explain the theme dividing these two episodes, the first part was speaking with Admiral Stavridis about the naval aspect of this future-facing conflict with China. And it's great to speak with Elliot about the nature of the past 20 years of war in Afghanistan and Iraq that's so different than the Admiral's experience.
I love talking with Elliot because Elliot, like you said, Marshall, is a guy who thinks deeply about warfare in the context of history. Really brought me back to my graduate school days. We talked about war in the cultural context in terms of the legacy of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, how it would inform military decision-making and thinking whenever it comes to an actual prospective war with China in a 2034 situation, and whether we as a society are really entering the late empire behavior. That's something you're going to hear a lot. There's a lot of nerding out here in terms of the history of warfare. I really, really enjoyed it, and it was phenomenal talking with Elliot.
Before we get into this amazing episode, we have a couple things to note. So one, just a reminder, we had a special bookshop that was set up for Elliot and Admiral Stavridis' book. People bought so many copies of 2034. It's so cool. We actually sent bookshop into back order mode for a second. So we would love for people who didn't get a chance to check out the book or their other recommendations on China to go. The link is in the show notes. And secondly, we are announcing a major change to the Realignment newsletter. We are no longer going to send it late in the day on Friday. We're going to send it this afternoon if you're listening on Thursday. So from now on, if you sign up for the Realignment Substack, which is also linked in the show notes, you'll receive that Thursday afternoon Eastern Standard Time every single Thursday. There'll be a lot of great announcements in that newsletter talking about our future plans.
With that, let's get to the question and answer period.
Today's question gets to a question we actually get a lot of time, so I wanted to take a second to highlight it. This is from GenX182 from Apple Podcasts. Quick reminder, if you would like to get your question read on air, send us an email at realignmentpod@gmail.com or leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts with the question included. The question is titled, "Like the show, but not sure if it's conservative. I've been listening for a few months and the topics and discussion are good, though the jargon can run a little high. I like the show, but I'm not sure if you guys are conservative, at least not in the way I think of conservatism. I'm older than your usual and clearly targeted demographic. That's also why I listen. We Gen Xers tend to be contrarian. Maybe the generational gap is the cause of my confusion. From what I've heard from the show, you are what I would consider center-left, particularly in your support for modern monetary theory, but maybe I'm hearing you wrong on this. My question, and more of a request, is would you run down the beliefs and policies that make you conservative, and what is your view of MMT?
That's a great question, Gen X, and the answer to your question is that this is not an ideological show in any way. This is a show where we ask questions, where we talk about history, where we talk about the implications of one policy or another. I don't think that that has to be liberal or conservative. I actually think one of the reasons we've been able to cultivate an audience deeply across both sides of the ideological spectrum is specifically because we have people who are like Medicare for all advocates on, and then we have guys like Weston Womp on who are against the national debt, and we just ask critical questions regardless of who the guest is, from Joe Scarborough to Admiral Stavridis to people who are in venture capital. And so I would really just urge you, especially if you came looking for a conservative show, to not do that, because going out and looking for ideological content, which is purely, especially one way, that's just really no way to live, my friend.
I just want to echo that. There was a funny Reddit thread on the Rising Reddit forum where people were saying, what does Marshall believe? I don't really get it. And I love that when that happens, honestly, because this has become a bit of a joke online, but we are to a certain degree just asking questions, because the part that I enjoy about this show specifically is the world's really complicated. And the more we podcast, I mean, Sagar, we've done 116 episodes of this, the less and less certain I've been about my thoughts on basically everything. And if there's one thing that's pretty clear, it's that almost no one holds the answers. And the whole reason why I loved the Frank DiStefano episode last week was Frank just made pretty clear the ideologies of liberal, conservative, neoliberal, whatever, they basically don't mean anything for the questions that this show is entirely interested in. So if you're just coming around thinking liberal, conservative, whatever, that's not going to help you answer the question of, hey, how should the U.S. respond to China in terms of the conversation we're having today? It's not going to say, hey, how should we consider the future of artificial intelligence, industrial policy, all these big topics. So I think what we want to really do to people is we're not here to tell you what to think. We're not here to be a liberal show. We're not here to be a conservative show. Sometimes we'll think different things, but we are here to give you the facts, bring interesting people, and grow them, especially when they have something interesting to say. But to the actual question you were asking, what are the thoughts on MMT? Yeah, I'm not an MMTer. I don't agree with everything that people like Stephanie Kelton say. But what I would agree, though, is that they bring a really useful framework to thinking about these debates, which is that the broader political point that Stephanie makes is that oftentimes when we're debating how much we can or can't spend, it's usually not purely a question of economics. It's actually a question of our priorities and what we really value. That's why the debates over spending inevitably turn into a degree of one side calling the other hypocritical. So I think that's the most useful thing that the MMTers bring to the table.
Well said. As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. Let's get to it.
Elliot Ackerman, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Good to see you, Elliot.
Elliot, what's great about speaking with you right now is oftentimes when a book has a co-author, there's the big name who's doing his thing, and then there's a person who's just doing the prose and everything that. But what I really appreciate about this is that, and from my opinion, you have just as much of an interesting background in the context of 2034 as Admiral Stavridis did. So we would love to follow up with you here on the themes of the book, how your background brought the perspective of the work. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So first question is basically this. You have written nonfiction, but you've obviously written multiple novels. What interested you in the work of speculative fiction that 2034 is?
This book sort of first came to me as a proposal from my editor at Penguin Press to work with Jim. And, Jim and I had known each other for 10 years. I liked him. I think he liked me. He was the dean at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and I was the writer in residence there for a summer. One of my bullet point kind of job descriptions for that semester was talk about books with the dean when he feels like it. I mean, so he and I kind of had spent, we spent lots of time just, shooting the breeze, talking about books. So I sort of knew his sensibility. And when he sort of had the idea of, trying to take this project on, we talked about it, had like a very much, an aligned vision of what the book would be, that it would be character driven, that it would kind of have this like big kind of global stage, but sort of also be something that was felt a little bit intimate. So I was just sort of, that excited me about the project. So the combination of all those things made it seem like something that was worth doing. And I think specifically with a novel, people remember, like, you remember characters, the books I enjoy the most, the characters, they're the ones that stick with me, long after I've finished that book. And so the challenge of trying to make a character-driven story around something that was dealing with these really big geopolitical themes seemed like a worthwhile one.
Mm-hmm. It's been fascinating, Elliot. The book has been selling tremendously well on our bookshop. And it was one of the, this organic viral thing amongst our audience where I wasn't necessarily sure how it would do. Obviously, I was just personally interested. So I was like, hey, let's talk to Admiral Stavridis. And part of the reason I wanted to talk to you as well is just your background. So you're actually talking to us on a pretty momentous day. I mean, President Biden announced today that we're going to be withdrawing all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th, 2021. You've written extensively about your own personal experience, in terms of Iraq and your own service. So I'm curious, both in the context of the book and your own story, how, if this is to be the cap of the forever wars, a 20-year period, in the world of 2034, how do you think about the legacy of those wars as we move towards something completely different? Because I don't know what military experience is coming next, but I just know it's probably not going to look like the U.S. military experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. Or maybe you completely disagree, and I'm curious for your thoughts.
First of all, I think it's interesting. I think, yes, today is momentous today, although I feel like the cynical vet in me would be remiss if I didn't say, like, oh yeah, I've heard that story before.
Oh, trust me. Yeah.
I mean, like, define troops.
Right. Yeah, right. 1,000 contractors. Right, don't look over there. Yeah.
Guys who wear uniforms but are not troops. Be the case. I mean, every American who takes a paycheck from the U.S. government, I will assure you, is not going to be out of Afghanistan by September of next year. We can debate whether or not they're troops. So, but listen, I say all that tongue in cheek. I mean, clearly we're sort of on the far side. I mean, hopefully this isn't a 40-year war. We're only approaching the halfway point. But it also gets these questions of what is the nature of modern war? How long do these wars go on? How do these wars fit into an American narrative, both the way we're fighting them with an all-volunteer military and putting the expenses on the national deficit, to their length? What does it mean? And this is a theme that comes up in the book, the fact that the United States is a nation that, used to be able to end wars. Now we're not very good at ending wars, but we're getting better at starting them all the time. And so what type of behavior is that? I would kind of classify it as late empire behavior. So those are all themes that, like, throughout my writing, whether it's in novels I've written or journalism that I do, I've engaged with in various ways. Marshall, you mentioned you read Places and Names. If you're Places and Names, I think I hit on many of those themes in Places of Names, if not all of them. So, but the thing that was fun in this was to project all those themes out forward, which is something I hadn't done before. And write, I mean, it's a work of speculative fiction. I'd say it's also a work of science fiction in many respects. We're sort of imagining a future that is not our own, and trying to understand how these experiences that are occurring today, which I've written about and thought about in depth, are now echoing forward 20 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to take us through what we would sort of classify as three specific eras of American warfare. So post-Cold War, 1990s, the conflicts that are quote unquote successful. So we're excluding Somalia, obviously, the Desert Storm, revolution and military affairs. The U.S. is laser guided bombs. There's obviously casualties, but there's nowhere near the casualties you really see or you thought people fearing. This is not Vietnam 2.0. You have the Balkans conflict where once again, you have something very asymmetric. You then have in the 2000s, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where initially complete success with both invasions, when the Taliban and the Iraqis try to compete with us from a perspective of military power, they lose, but it proceeds into counterinsurgency and occupation. And then in the world of 2034, it's a world of great power conflict where there's actual ability and parity between the different military forces. So can you just, as both a veteran, but someone who's trying to project these things forward, can you just reflect on these three different eras, two of which happened, and then one you're then looking forward into?
Yeah, I'll kind of maybe make a macro statement to begin that reflection, which is, listen, if we look at the last 100 years, right, I think we could say the last 100 years, we could categorize it as an American century. And it's American century that was forged in two great cauldrons, the First and the Second World War. And those were wars that were not begun by the United States, right? We sure finished both of those wars, and we finished on terms that were very advantageous to us. And I would say, you know, those of us who have lived and come of age in this American century are beneficiaries of those wars. So when we look at the wars we've been fighting recently, again, they're wars that we have not been able to finish. And we keep engaging in these behaviors. And because we come from a relatively wealthy society, we're able to keep engaging in these behaviors, even though I would argue they are destructive behaviors. They're late empire behaviors. And if we look back historically, when empires keep engaging in these types of behaviors, eventually they end very, very badly. And so the premise of 2034 is, it's a book about a war that begins between the United States and China. And that's true. But neither the United States nor China are the ones who truly finished the war. And when I say finish, I mean finish it in the way I mean the United States finished the First and Second World War. I won't give the book away, but there's another third party who is able to finish and take advantage of the geopolitical reordering post-2034. So I think it's important to be mindful of that. And we've seen this throughout history, right? You know, this idea of the Thucydides trap, which is that you have a established power meets a rising power. This has happened since the era of the Peloponnesian War, and the rising power challenges the established power. And whenever you have that dynamic, you're going to, in preponderance of situations, have a war. And the one that's closest to the boat in our memory and recent memory is, you know, Britain, established power, Germany, rising power at the opening of the 20th century. And that leads to both the First World War and then right on its heels, the Second World War. So you could say that right now you have a similar dynamic, United States established power, China rising power. You know, are we in one of these Thucydides traps? But the
quick question, Elliot, before we move on, because we had, I'm just smiling because we had Josh Rogan from the Washington Post on after Admiral Stavridis, and Josh was very adamant that he doesn't believe the Thucydides trap idea as a framework is accurate. Historically, broadly. So do you think it's an accurate model of looking at international relations?
I think it's an accurate model of looking at it. It doesn't mean it's a determinative model, but I think you can certainly look to and see a pattern that, yes, in the history of mankind, there is this pattern of established power challenging, or rising power challenging an established power, and that leading to warfare. I mean, now, does that mean that it always leads to warfare? No, I don't think it always leads to warfare, but you can certainly see that dynamic play out throughout history. But I think what's interesting in that dynamic is there's always a binary assumption there, right? Rising power challenges established power. Who's going to win? Is the established power going to hold on for another century, or is the rising power going to overtake them? Well, if you look in the case of, you know, Germany and the UK, that led to our most recent, I'd say, Thucydides trap style war. Germany and the United Kingdom fought the First World War, they fought the Second World War against one another. And guess what? Neither of them won. Mm-hmm. So this idea that you win, I think, is a fool's gambit.
I want to interrogate this a little bit, because the second time you talked about late empire behavior, and it occurs to me, like, if you make the timeline long enough, I mean, are the Chinese the declining empire, right? Or are they like in a weird, like a boomerangish type behavior? Because if you think about it from their perspective, they don't really think of themselves as a rising power. They would probably think of themselves as a resurgent power or reclaiming some sort of new status on the global stage. So could maybe incorporate that a bit into your framework about, first of all, is America, you know, declining late empire? Like, what is the evidence for that strong given the experience in Iraq and Afghanistan? So, for example, if we're going to compare this to like Rome and the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, or even, you know, I don't know my Greek history as well, but like, it seems like the late empire wars that they got into, which were a disaster, were like a total and complete disaster. And I'm not saying I don't think the Iraq and Afghanistan U.S. military experience weren't disasters, but they weren't necessarily like societal collapse, like, you know, cleavage, half the country gone. Like, yes, you know, blood, treasure, and nobody's probably talked about it more than us on this podcast. I'm curious, you know, are we a late empire? Like, let's target it from one side and on the other side, from the Chinese side.
Well, I think that's the question. Mm-hmm. The question worth asking. I mean, it's, you know, are you an alcoholic the first time you get wasted, hop in your car, puke all over the dashboard, and catch you? Or do you have to have 10 times before you're an alcoholic? You know, and many alcoholics have debated that question. So that's why I say we are engaging in late empire behavior. Mm-hmm. Are we a late empire? I don't know, because the empire hasn't fallen yet. So it's whether or not it falls, right? You know, are you an alcoholic? Who's to say? Are you engaging in alcoholic behavior? If you, you know, drink too much, throw up all over your dashboard and crash your car, I would argue, yes, you are engaging in alcoholic behavior. So I think when we, you know, fight a war for 20 years, that particularly in the last, I don't know, 15 years of it, doesn't really seem to have a purpose that our policymakers can clearly articulate to the American people. When that war is structured around a all-volunteer military and is funded through deficit spending. And oh, by the way, you know, so the American people don't feel it, but my oh, by the way is, you know, if we look, because you brought up the Romans, I mean, one of the late empire behaviors the Romans engaged in was they increasingly outsourced their legions. So they were recruited, right, not from Rome, they were recruited in the provinces. So other cultures were doing their fighting. You know, Gallic cultures, Spanish cultures, you know, the people who are from the sort of furthest reaches of the Roman Empire. Well, now what we do with our all-volunteer military is we're really recruiting our military from a subculture of American life, where increasingly there's this vast civil military divide. People in the military have a very different culture than sort of broader facets of U.S. American culture. And I would argue, you know, that is a similar late empire style behavior. So these are all things that concern me. You know, do I think that America is like definitely going off the cliff or off the cliff? Like, no, I have reason to be plenty optimistic about America, but I think it's worthwhile that we, you know, that we have a general awareness, like, hey, like, this is not great stuff we're doing. This is not positive behavior for a republic.
Absolutely.
That is the understatement of our entire podcast history. Here's the question then. Given you've written about the impact of the draft going away and like the nature of the culture of the military, you're just making this point about class divides within the military. This wasn't discussed as much in 2034, but without spoilers, of course, serious conflict between the US and China. How do you think the military culture we have today really runs up against the space? So for example, if we're talking about Pearl Harbor, if we're talking about World War I, those were obviously not only different American societies, but different American military cultures. How do you think the status quo military culture runs up to an actual great power conflict with serious casualties?
I think you hit on the serious casualties. So that's the biggest thing right there. Our military, as it's designed today, is not designed to fight a war in which there are going to be serious casualties, i.e. we're going to need a military that's bigger than the current active duty military that we have today. What we have today is a military that's very well engineered to fight forever wars. And that, again, it comes from a subculture. It's an all-volunteer force, and it is resourced not through a war tax, but through the type of deficit spending that people, citizens, don't feel in their pocketbooks. So these wars kind of, you know, they net politically neutral. I mean, I think it's worth remembering that every war the United States has fought since our revolution has had to have a construct built around it to sustain it, right? I mean, remember Thomas Paine's, you know, common sense. These are the times that try men's souls. I mean, George Washington was literally reading that to his troops before they crossed the Delaware. And it was quite literal. These are the times of tribesmen's souls, meaning, hey guys, I know your enlistments are up right now and you want to go home for Christmas, but please, if you give me 2 more weeks, you know, we're going to go kick the crap out of the British across the Delaware River, and this will all be worth it. And some of them stuck around, some of them didn't. To our Civil War, right? Our Civil War, the first income tax we see in this country and the first draft we ever see were created to sustain our Civil War, which, oh, by the way, you know, weren't particularly popular. I know we all know about the draft riots in New York City in 1863, okay? To Second World War, national mobilization, we all know, you know, we all know about that. Or the Vietnam War, which is characterized by a very unpopular draft that ultimately was catalytic in ending that war. To our wars today, a forever war, created and sustained through an all-volunteer military and deficit spending. I mean, it's the reason these wars have gone on now for 20 years is not because we haven't been able to find the right battlefield alchemy in Iraq and Afghanistan. I would argue we haven't been able to do that. But they've gone on this long because there's just been no domestic political will to end it.
It's fascinating because I, you know, covering this, I realized sometime around like 2015, 16 or so, I was like, oh, as long as like 20, oh, it's, and this sounds very callous, but like, this is basically the calculus I think that was made in the Pentagon and by political leaders. They're like, as long as it's only like you lose like 25 guys a year in Afghanistan, most people just don't care. And that's actually like deeply sad and troubling. And it's like you said, which is that in an increasingly bifurcated civil-military relations country, one of the most fascinating studies I read from 2017 was actually that controlling for everything, so basically like age, gender, etc., counties where there were increased military casualties, as in actual deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan, actually swung towards Trump in a very statistically significant way, which I was really interested by. And I think it's, you know, very much could have something to do with his message there. So on the domestic political construct, I've been thinking a long time about how exactly those two things interact. I'm curious from your perspective, where can the current construct of the military incorporate domestic political concerns? Because I think something that's been very frustrating to me, and just, you know, for my background, like I went to Georgetown, got my master's there in security studies. I met a lot of people who are now working in the U.S. State Department and high-level officials in the Pentagon. I covered the Pentagon as a journalist. It was always so frustrating to me that I felt as if there was this like doctrine of like, this is like, we know and we know better, that was totally and completely divorced from domestic political considerations. Is that a result of the all volunteer military and kind of an elitization, that's not a word, of the military and the Pentagon, et cetera? I'm curious for your reflections on that.
Yeah, I'll give an answer and let me know if it hits the first of all, I think it's very concerning, and the founding fathers knew this, that, you know, they knew intuitively in their bones that, like, first of all, dysfunctional internal politics combined with extremely large, well-equipped, well-trained professional military, it doesn't end well in republics historically. Like that doesn't usually have a happy ending in democratic republics. And that's exactly the construct we're sitting with today. So yes, like that does very much concern me. You know, like let's just do a thought experiment and like flip the script for a second. You know, let's say a few months ago that, let's say Trump had won. I think had Trump won, the election would have been contested. I think everyone, both sides were, and I'm not making this as a partisan, I'm not trying to make partisan. Mm-hmm. I think both sides were, you know, totally ready to contest. So let's say he'd won, it was contested by the Democrats. And let's say we had seen like an equivalent of like a Lafayette Square, but now it's not over the BLM stuff, it's over a contested election. And the messaging coming from the Democrats is he's stealing the election, which was Trump's messaging, and this wasn't a legitimate election. The messaging coming from Trump is, I'm a legitimate president. This is an unlawful protest. You're basically trying to assault the White House, kind of, you know, as was happening in front of Lafayette Square. And the military now gets called in just as was getting called in Lafayette Square. And so now you've got uniformed service members standing at the barricades. The messaging they're getting from the chief executive is, you know, law and order needs to be established. I'm the president of the United States. and the messaging they're getting from a whole other class of political leaders is this person is not the legitimate president of the United States. Ergo, his orders as the commander in chief should be coming into question right now. And so I'm not saying either side. So you're basically going to put a whole bunch of military leaders, and I'm not even talking about like four-star generals, lieutenant colonels who are in command of a battalion, you know, in this position of, so choose, whose orders are you going to follow? Are his orders legitimate? I work as a journalist, I covered the war in Syria. And one of the things in Syria, the moment where you really saw that conflict, I'm not saying we're Syria, but just as a paradigm, where you really saw that go off the rails was when the military started defecting. Because the problem is when the military says, okay, you know what? Like, you're right, side X or side Y, I'm with you now. It's not just like the one battalion commander's like, okay, I'm going to pick up my picket sign. He says, you know what? I'm with you. And by the way, I've got four tanks here. Where do you want them? And that's when things go completely out of control. Now, I'm not saying that's what was going to happen, but, you know, we should just, again, if we live in a republic, like we should stop and take a minute and ask ourselves, what is the cost of what I think is a very real civil military divide? And I'll just give you a number that should, I think, give everyone a little bit of pause in this respect. And this just came out earlier in the week. In the Marine Corps, 40% of active duty Marines, all of whom for a long time now have had access to the coronavirus vaccine, 40% have refused to take it.
I saw that, yeah.
You know, now I'm not like casting judgment there, but I'm more just so showing like that to me is evidence that people are living in very divergent realities right now.
Mm-hmm. It's
an alarm assault.
Quick question on that. Is there an officer enlisted breakdown?
I was going to say, when it comes to that? I bet you it's dramatic.
Yeah, it's pretty dramatic. I mean, I can only speak anecdotally. Like I've seen that, you know, all of my peers who I was in the Marines with are now like battalion commanders. They're all leading units of kind of like about 1,000 Marines. And several months ago, a buddy of mine who remained nameless, who's a battalion commander, was sort of telling me anecdotally, like, yeah, we can all get it. I just got both my vaccines. None of my guys will take it. And I was talking to another friend of mine who I was in special operations with, and he is part of the he's part of a 14-man team and the leadership of that team. And he said, of the 14 guys in that team, you know, and these are special operators who are generally older, more mature, sophisticated guys who've had to pass rigorous selection courses to even get there. Of the 14 in the team, only two will take the vaccine. None of the others.
I think it's a cult. It's just cult. It's a cultural disconnect, which nobody is grappling with. And I want to underscore like a historical point on this, because the scenario you laid out has happened so many different times. Like every coup or revolution or whatever in like modern history, immediately my mind turns to Russia. That scenario about like lieutenant colonels and sergeants and them making decisions on whether to support the regime or not has happened twice in the 1900s in Russia. Like during the Tsar in 1989, like that's basically exactly, you know, the scenario that happened.
Lieutenant Colonel Gaddafi.
Egypt. Yeah,
Colonel Nasser, there's a theme here.
There's a common theme that's happening out in the Middle East. Like these aren't so far removed from history. Like we're not talking about Janissaries, you know, going back to the Ottoman Empire. Anyway, Marshall, I know you have a question.
Just a quick question that I'm wondering about. Something the show focuses on, I think you wrote a piece in Time about this, just this idea of the hyper-politicization of every single aspect of American society. I wonder how you think the military is handling that dynamic. So something that a lot of our right-leaning listeners were very exercised about a few months ago was, for example, Tucker Carlson, obviously Fox News host, was talking about the military's gender policies, especially related to transgender people. And then you then had, I can't remember if it was a Marine.
Sergeant Major.
I think it may have been someone in the very high up in the enlisted side of the Marine Corps, I believe, did a social media post against Tucker. And there's obviously the articulation of the fact that, look, this is him defending his people. But there's also like, that's a very political act. So how do you just think about how the military is going to have to struggle through these issues as they become politicized in ways they haven't been in a long time?
Don't politicize the military. It's like a big fat loser for everybody. There's no way to like successfully politicize the military and have it work out well for this country. I'm just sorry. Like, there's no way to do it. If you say everyone has to choose a side, it's not like everyone chooses the same side in the military. Like, you can't go there. You just can't. I mean,
I know.
If we politicize the U.S. military, I mean, it's going to make January 6th just look like a total warm-up act. I am like truly concerned about that, because there's no way to do it. I mean, if you look back to our own Civil War and you read first-person accounts of the professional military officers, you know, in the march to secession, you know, up to and including Robert E. Lee, who many people forget, Lincoln's first choice to lead the Army of the Potomac was Robert E. Lee. And Lee basically said, to him, listen, I can't fight against my country. And in his mind, you know, how they thought about it, his country was Virginia. So I have to choose my country. But it's very clear, like, that was not, at least in 1861, like a choice he really wanted to make. Like, it was just tore him apart and tore so many other people apart to make it on both sides. But if you force people and back them into a corner to say, you know, hey, which way to, you know, because probably everybody leans one way or another, but like, don't force people to lean all the way. And so I have just real concerns if this trend spills in and we politicize the military in the way we've seen every other facet of American life now politicized. It's like totally corrosive. And the only problem with the military is you've got armored divisions and infantry battalions. And again, this just goes back to kind of, you know, what I was saying before, late empire behavior. If you look at republics that have large standing militaries with totally dysfunctional politics at home, traditionally, it does not end well.
Mm-hmm. I want to pivot because we're on the particularly depressing end of the conversation without any clear solutions, deeper perspective or anything like that. I want to talk about a couple of themes from the book that stuck out that I'm really curious to get your perspective on. So one, I'm asking you this both as a novelist, but also as a veteran, obviously. In the book, once again, not too many spoilers, a major plot point is the fact that much of America's vaunted technological superiority is used. I think this was in the Wired excerpt, so we can talk about it. So there's a scene where an F-35, obviously a very advanced warplane, is effectively hijacked, and that's very important. Ghost Fleet, which was a book in 2015 by P.W. Singer and August Cole that we really enjoyed in this genre, also features something similar with F-35s also getting hacked. And then for the sci-fi nerds here, Battlestar Galactica 2003, huge plot point is the most advanced Viper Mark 7s are taken out by the Cylons and they have to go back to 40-year-old tech. So we've now seen, at least in our literary imagination, this idea that our weapons and our technology will be used against us. So I don't think anyone in the Pentagon should be surprised in 2034 or something like that happens. How do you as a novelist think of like themes and cliches and things like that, right? So in the sense that it shouldn't be a surprise that an F-35 could get hacked, if you kind of get where I'm trying to articulate it the right way, but if we're sitting in 2034, what Pentagon planner should be totally surprised by the possibility that that could happen? Because in all of these books and all these different novels in the TV series, it's always a surprise. So what do you just think about that? If we're talking about something like that now?
Yeah. I mean, I'll do you one better, St. Crispin's Day, 1415, France, you know, King Henry V leads out his like scraggly British army that's poorly equipped, not many heavily armored knights, but they do have these newfangled longbows that are really effective. And the cream of the French army has marched out onto the field, heavily armored knights, the most advanced technology you can imagine. And they are just going to slaughter the English. And the only thing standing between them is this, you know, one kind of rain the night before, a muddy patch of earth. And the French charge the English. The French, with all their highfalutin armor, get bogged down in the mud, and the English just rain arrows down on them, and win the Battle of Agincourt. I mean, like, this is as old, and that's one of the things about writing about war. It's as old as mankind. You know, you can see all the same patterns. And I mean, I'm you know, like that was something that was very much in my mind. I would recommend the Kenneth Branagh version of Henry V, great movie, which has a pretty amazing climactic battle scene that shows the Battle of Agincourt. So, you know, the idea and the central theme of the book is like, yes, technology is great, so long as you have the right technology. And the history of warfare is littered with the headstones of soldiers who served in armies where they had, you know, the most advanced technology, but it was the wrong technology. And there was a new technology that might not have been more sophisticated or more complex, but that was right for that battle and right for that moment. And so you have to have not only the latest technology, but also the right technology. And we see that kind of perennially coming up through 2034 as one of the great faults of our American thinking.
Yeah, I'm also thinking of, is it the Ottoman siege of Vienna, where like it was really rainy and that was the only reason they couldn't bring their big cannons, which they almost certainly would have defeated Vienna. Like, and people are always like retconning this because it would have meant that you would have had like an Ottoman presence all the way up in Austria, which would have, you know, could have rebalanced Europe and all of that. I'm really enjoying a lot of the references here. One of the other constants in warfare is that it's like you said, the technology that ends up is supposed to be groundbreaking never ends up is, but some sort of technology does end up groundbreaking. So, for example, within World War One, you know, basically a lot of people will go back and say the script for World War One was written right there in 1865 at the end of the American Civil War in terms of entrenchments, in terms of artillery and all of that. But it was not predicted whatsoever, and the planners themselves didn't plan for it. When you were writing the book, how are you thinking of it from that perspective? As in, like Marshall's saying, it's almost cliche to say at this point, you know, the F-35 is going to crash. I mean, as far as I know, like naval cadets are now relearning how to navigate by stars in order to combat the idea of like a Chinese EMP weapon or anybody's EMP weapon, which would wipe out people's electronics so they can navigate again on the open seas like in the 1700s. But some sort of technology will make the difference if we were to have a conflict with China. How did you just think about it from that perspective as a historian yourself of warfare?
It's adaptability. I mean, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the military theorist William Boyd, who coined the phrase
loop.
Observe, orient, decide, act, right? So observe, you know, oh, this is what they're doing. Orient yourself. Okay, this is what it means. I'm deciding this is how I'm going to respond, and then I act on my response. It's about your OODA loop. You know, you've got to, okay, my technology has been wiped out. You know, what do I have at my disposal? I can navigate by the stars. That's okay. But I can also cobble together this other technology that seems like it's still going to work. You know, I make a decision how to employ it and then I act. So, you know, it's not a no technology book. It's just a book where you see people kind of trapped in this OODA loop of warfare. And then I would also put that, you know, so much of warfare too, so much of this, what you see playing out time and time again in wars is kind of technology meeting culture and the two not matching up. So, you know, you brought up the Civil War, and as we all know, like the Civil War was fought really up until like the very, very end when Napoleonic era tactics, because culture was still this cult of the offense. And that culture was well suited to battles in which you fire smoothbore muskets, which have a maximum effective range of about like 60 to 80 yards. So, you know, you get within 60 to 80 yards, you follow one, fire one volley, then you charge and you settle it with a bayonet. Civil War, the maximum effective range of a rifle musket, so new technology rifling, now takes that to like 250 yards. So you're firing those volleys at each other for like ever before you even get into bayonet range.
And the mini ball, I believe, was also more deadly.
Well, like the mini ball was the rifle, was right, the rifle ball that allows for that accuracy. So, you know, but they didn't understand this new technology. So they had like the old culture with the new technology, and it was totally devastating. And you see the same thing in the First World War. So again, in 2034, you know, I would assume, because, you know, we're humans and we keep doing the same dumb stuff over and over again, and in this next war, you're going to have a similar mismatch of culture with technology. And we have a culture right now that, for better or worse, oftentimes worships technology at the expense of really understanding what it can do for us, but also kind of sometimes what it can't do for us. And so how does that culture mesh with the type of war we're going to fight? And, you know, we see at moments like the gears kind of grinding against each other in 2034.
You know, the culture point is fascinating, because if you're looking at the type of conflict that you're describing in 2034. It's much more of a Cold War era conflict in the sense that there's military parity. This isn't the Taliban and the remnants of Al-Qaeda running into the mountains after September 11th. This is aircraft carriers, sixth generation fighter planes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That being said, the military brass who would be in charge of this conflict would be a set of folks who came of age or who really earned their stars during these forever war conflicts. So that's part of the dynamic on the US side. And then on the Chinese side, I think it's fascinating that the Chinese really haven't fought wars in a very long time. And the last time they did fight a war, they actually, I think, lost to Vietnam, technically speaking, which is a weird end of the 1970s bookend to the way the Vietnam War ends.
Yeah.
What?
There was a thing with India.
I don't just mean a conflict. I mean an actual full-on like nation-to-nation conflict. So how do you think of the Chinese, the People's Liberation Army, how do you think of them as an actor, as an institution? We've focused on the U.S. side so much here.
I think it's interesting. I mean, listen, we have fought a war with China. I mean, we essentially fought a war with, we did fight a war with China on the Korean Peninsula in the 1950s. So we do have that as a touch point. But I think, what you see in the book vis-a-vis a Chinese is sort of the Chinese characters are feeling that they have superiority in their ability to long-range plan, to be deliberate in a way that the United States cannot. And you see that manifest in the characters. But then you also see how the Chinese system in the book reacts to battlefield defeats and how it turns inward on itself in a way that the American system does not. And I just put out an idea kind of while we're talking about it. One of the narratives that's out there right now with regards to the coronavirus is that the coronavirus in some ways has sort of proven the superiority of the Chinese system and cast doubts on Western democracy as being able to really act effectively in a direct way to take on with single-minded determination and challenge. And I tell you what, to quote Mugatu in Zoolander, I feel like I'm eating crazy pills. are you kidding me? Like, how did we get here? The Chinese system is what gave us the coronavirus. If there had been transparency and open journalism, the ability to investigate what was going on, to get right on top of this virus, it would not have spread. It would not have existed.
Also, their vaccine has 50%. Right. Sinovac is the shittiest vaccine. Brazil came out and was like, yo, this thing only works for half the time.
I feel like I'm totally insane. And here in the US, and I'm telling you, half the Marines won't even take the vaccine. They're trying to give it away. And we didn't even make this thing. But the China is not 20 feet tall. You know what I mean? It's not. And I think that, sometimes the American system, we tend to feel down on ourselves a little bit, maybe perhaps too easily. And earlier in the show, we're talking about all these things. I'm very bullish on America.
Why is that?
And I feel like, we endemically are our own worst enemy. And there's a quote that is in the book, spoken by one of the characters here. He mentions, something Lincoln said. Which is that, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but, Lincoln basically said, all the armies of the world couldn't take a sip from the Ohio River. If we are going to, we're either going to live on as a nation of free men or perish by suicide. And I believe that those are certainly prophetic words. We very much hold our fate in our hands. And so, again, so when I sort of hear these narratives, you ask about how the Chinese see themselves. I don't know if they're drinking their own Kool-Aid on that, if they really believe it, but I don't know how you can, with a straight face, tell us that COVID proves the superiority of the Chinese system. Like I said, I feel like I'm eating crazy pills every time I hear that.
Well, I'm so glad you brought this up because it also brings to mind a terrible Orientalist cliche that I've been hearing ever since terrible Thomas Friedman or Fareed Zakaria things back in high school. The whole the Chinese can plan super long and we in the West
checkers
just can't.
And
maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but it's just a cliche that everyone just says. So I appreciate you guys not invoking that just generic cliche that I used to work at PBS and the number of times that people would just generically just nod our heads very wisely. Oh yes, that's how it works. Because in many ways, I think if you're looking at the past 4 years, I think it's a clear demonstration that in many ways, like, the CCP made a bunch of terrible miscalculations. You had a situation in 2017, you saw this initially, where Xi Jinping is at the World Economic Forum and talking about how we, the Chinese, are going to uphold the post-World War II international order. We believe in free trade. We want international peace and comedy, all those things, really using Trump as a very obvious, like, you know, counterpoint. But then over the next 3 years, you see hostility to the CCP rise across not just the West, but across East Asia, across other parts of the Asia Pacific region. So I just think it's fascinating that I just appreciated the nuanced dynamic to the Chinese system that you all provided.
Yeah, I said, like, the spirit of this book is not like Americans, here's a story about the evil Chinese, we must gird ourselves for battle. I mean, that's not the spirit of this book. The spirit of this book is like, hey, let's all imagine this war from like everyone's perspective. And let's like let every character step onto the page and make their case to the reader like they're making their case before God. And then when you finish this book, what I hope you kind of walk away with is you walk away and say, like, wow, that would be, to engage in that behavior would be so bad and so stupid. Why would any of us ever go to war? Like, life is pretty good. Let's avoid that tragedy. That's the spirit of the book. And I hope we can get back to that and step away from some of the saber rattling that all parties are engaging in right now.
Right.
So as we're nearing the end here, Sagar, I want to bring up two themes that really fascinate us. I'll start here. I was really interested, as I was just reading the book without looking into either of your backgrounds, the fact that the president in 2034 is not from either political party. So there's two different levels that you could have that discussion. One is like, that's an obvious and I think correct choice to remove the domestic political considerations because there's too many factors. It just wouldn't be as useful as a construct. But like, once I realized who you were and your background of Americans elect in terms of like your interest in like your interest in 2012 of trying to promote reform within the American political system, I thought maybe there was something more to it there. So two questions. Question one is, I'm just adding things because I'm excited because I thought this was fascinating. I thought it was very interesting that in this case, the independent candidate chose to uphold like the bipartisan direction of U.S. foreign policy in the sense of those big consensus issues. So I think the specific line was something like, the third party candidate chose to continue the path that previous Democrat and Republican administrations had followed as regards China policy. So pro Taiwan, pro South China Sea. And I just want to know how you think about this as a former Politico. Do you think any type of third party system shaking movement would inherently follow the bipartisan consensus? Because I just don't know quite how that works. I think it would be different domestically, but I don't know how it would work on the international front.
Yeah. Well, first of all, specifically to the book, I would say it's very nice when your political interests align with your narrative interests. narrative interests, it's like, well, are you going to make the president a Republican or a Democrat? Like, that doesn't work. I don't want to write a book that has like, that then feels like it's skewed one way or another. And who is this person? And, you know, narratively, if the president walks into the room, that character like immediately sucks up all the oxygen in the room. And that scene is about the president. And this book was not going to be about a president. It was going to be about kind of all the people a level below that, who you kind of see in all their quirky humanity, or hopefully you do. So I think that just aligned nicely narratively. Now, that being said, politically, like, this is something I'm interested in. I don't think it's implausible that you will see an independent emerge. And I say independent instead of third party, just because I think traditionally, like, third parties are quixotic and lame. Like, they never seem to work. You know, if there are three parties, you know, who gets stuck being the third, right? I wouldn't want to be the third. I want to be the first party. So I just say independent because I think Americans get independence, right? Our first president was an independent. And when he was walking out the door in Washington's farewell address, he warned about what he called factions and how they would be deleterious to the republic. And obviously we saw, you know, immediately after his presidency, we had factions which emerged into the, you know, the two-party system we've had to this day, although there's been many iterations of those parties. I think as Americans, we often sort of assume, you know, like somewhere in our founding documents, is that there shall be two parties and they shall be called Republican and Democrat. And obviously that is not the case. Our system has evolved, and increasingly for a whole variety of reasons, we could probably do a whole nother podcast on, you know, the classic constructs of, you know, the RNC and the DNC as institutions have become increasingly less powerful, particularly with regards to fundraising post Citizens yep. United, and particularly, you know, in a media climate, you know, where we've seen you don't need them to be, and they aren't, they just frankly aren't the gatekeepers they once were. You know, I would argue that frankly, the first politically independent president that we've had in a long time was Donald Trump. I think Trump actually ran his candidacy as an independent. He just said, you know what, I'm gonna hijack the Republican Party, which I think, you know, if you watch his campaign, he kind of did at gunpoint, like then took it over, made it his own. But you know, like, do you believe? I don't believe Donald Trump is a Republican. I don't think Donald Trump was sitting around in 2014, 2015, like thinking about, well, I don't think he was like a pre-2016 Republican. Yeah. He was an opportunist who like rolled in and said, I'm going to run for president. I think this is the lane I can do it in. I'm going to start with all this Obama birther stuff. Cause I think that's like a fertile, you know, hoe to plant my seeds in. And then said, and through that, I'm going to like totally take over this party. And he did it. And now it's kind of his thing. But I only bring that up because, I think he shows you how, for good or ill, the political system can kind of radically change. And I think the Republican Party, let me just say, Mitt Romney's Republican Party of 10 years ago doesn't look a whole lot like Trump's today. And it increasingly is looking less and less like Mitt's Republican Party. So I don't use Mitt because he's like the last, you know, Republican presidential candidate you had. So again, I think, again, that's a whole nother podcast, but I think if we're thinking about what the political world is going to look like domestically in the year 2034, I don't think it's going to look like John McCain versus Obama.
Well, I want to follow up because back to Marshall's question, actually, within that. So in a radically shifting political environment, also, I hope everybody who's ever asked us about third parties re-listens to that answer. As we've said, third parties aren't the answer. Taking over a hollowed out party is the answer.
Okay. Independents are the answer.
Yes. Independents taking over. It doesn't matter. You know, anyway, I could do it. Like you said, we could literally do it.
We get a lot of a quick thing, Elliot. We get so much audience Q&A of when are you guys going to sit? We're like, guys, please stop.
We're like, third parties are lame. They don't work. And it's also never going to happen. All right. So it's finally out of the way. But here's the question. In a radically changing political environment, do the assumptions around China stay the same? That's kind of what Marshall was getting at. And I literally don't know the answer to that question. Because
I don't necessarily know either. I think it's very interesting that as we have like gotten so far away from one another on domestic issues, there's like zero political overlap on so many domestic issues. The foreign policy still seems to be an area where there is a relative degree of consensus between the two parties. You know, part of that, I think, is because the wars have been sort of taken off the books for all the reason we just discussed, how they've sort of been constructed. Like most Americans, or at least a critical mass of Americans, don't feel them in the way they feel other issues, whether it's, you know, climate or, you know, abortion or immigration, you name it. People don't feel so violently, intensely about our foreign policy. I mean, obviously, that hasn't always been the case, you know. Go back to the 1960s when it was, you know, incredibly hot button issue. And I think it could change again. You know, in 2034, it has not changed in the novel significantly. And that, I think, is why you see a continuation of policy.
Yeah. And just a quick comment, and then Sagar, throw the casualties question and then we'll wrap. But I'm just thinking a lot about your invocation of Trump as the first independent, because it gets to the theme of what we're talking about, which is that in many ways, he's obviously very hostile and hawkish on China, but in many ways, he's also very hostile to the world order that sums up a lot of this. So my favorite part of the books, frankly, with your characters, especially Wedge, by the way, was him reflecting on Wedge's a fighter pilot in the book. Him just reflecting on knowing that the world that his grandfather and his father, the world that they had come up in, was just gone. And it wasn't quite clear what the next one was, but just the awareness of that. And in many ways, that's what a version of Trump is going. So I think that was just really poignant. And I really appreciated that part of the book. Cause I think it spoke to a feeling that people clearly have
No, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and go ahead, Elliot. You can comment on that.
No, I was just going to offer, I'm like just sort of from one, just as like one kind of like Rorschach testy thing with the word independent. Like, and tell me if I'm projecting here, guys. If I am, fair enough, and I apologize. Like, I can sense you guys don't like saying Trump was the first independent president. Like, it catches in your throat maybe a little bit. But hold on, before you tell me if I'm right or wrong, I only bring that up in the context of, I think as Americans, we have positive connotations with the words independent or independence. Like, we like that word. That's a good word, you know? So that's when I say like third parties or land, like independence, like, you know, I think we want our politicians to be independent and to have sort of an agenda that is just not the party's agenda, which goes back to this idea that I think core to our DNA is actually this fact that we are not people who just sift into parties, right? We're America. We're kind of founded on this idea, these Enlightenment ideas of the individual being sort of the central unit that the state is built around to protect. So anyways, I'm not particularly on you, and maybe it's not you guys, but often when I say a lot, I've said before, like, I think Trump is like probably the first independent president. Like, people kind of like spit up their drinks. They're nauseated by it.
No. We've actually talked about it a fair amount here on the podcast, specifically to that point about well, here's the question. Was Trump not a Republican, or were the Republicans not Republicans? Because it turns out Republican voters love Trump. So it's like, did he actually know them better than they knew themselves? I actually probably
politicians love power. They're right. Not anything. They want power. However they get it, they want power. I mean, those are just my views. But, you know, Marshall, I didn't totally answer your question with regards to Wedge. But yes, Wedge as a character is sort of this throwback to 20th century kind of America's 20th century sense of itself. And his, you're right, his great-grandfather is also a fighter pilot who flew with Pappy Boynton, a famous Marine fire ace in the South Pacific. And so much of Wedge's journey in the book, without giving too much away, is trying to situate, like, what place, if any, does that sort of old American kind of figure have in this 21st century?
Yeah, and the last thing I wanted to bring up here, and this is a question Marshall and I were actually talking about in this context, which is that the book, and again, not giving away spoilers, but like, this is obvious if we were ever getting into a war with China, there's like real casualties. That's just something that America has not dealt with since World War II. I mean, even during Vietnam, at the height of the Vietnam War, you're losing like, what, 500, 600 guys. I think the worst day of the Vietnam War was like a couple hundred guys in a day. I mean, whenever you lose a carrier group, like, you're losing thousands of people, like, in a single minute. Right. And it's just something that we haven't really discussed or even dealt with in so long and so many generations. I'm curious from your perspective, what culturally that feels like, because I saw an interesting stat around the pandemic, which is that basically nobody gives a shit until 2% of the population dies. Right. So like, it has to get so bad so that like, you know, somebody who knows somebody who didn't just get but sick, but is dead. And I think that that's probably the same case whenever it comes to warfare, where you have to reach a critical mass of, you either know somebody in the service, somebody who was wounded, or somebody who died. And that's kind of the type of conflict that we're talking about here. So socioculturally, to think of it from that perspective, what do you think the ramifications culturally for dealing with something like that are? How does that play out in such a divided country? Will we even be divided in that time? It's really teed up for you.
Yeah, I would just reframe a little bit and say, you know, we just went through right now, 500,000 Americans are dead this past year. Mm-hmm. And that's more than in all of World War II we just lost. And I think it gets to a little bit, is like, sir, so what's the story around it? You know, I mean, listen, I'm sure you guys have heard the infamous quote by Stalin, right? You know, one dead person is a tragedy, 1 million dead statistic. And I think a lot of that goes to just sort of the narrative around why we are losing people. And I think like with the pandemic, for instance, it sort of has been like difficult to comprehend. I don't know about you guys, like, I myself know people who have died in this pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I bet most Americans probably do, if not directly, they're at least one step removed from someone who's died in the pandemic. And the pandemic has interrupted our lives since the Second World War. And so I think it's the combination not only of the loss, the numbers, but that interruption of life. Like, whatever you were doing before, you're not doing anymore because of the pandemic, because of World War II, because of the war with China that started in the Chalcedonian Sea. You're not doing it anymore. So it's a combination of you're not doing your life anymore, and oh, by the way, lots of people are dying. And I think that kind of 1-2 is what jolts people out of their reality. It makes it impossible to ignore.
That's a good point.
And last actual question. We asked this to Admiral Stavridis, but you offered a couple book recommendations on warfare, on the US and China in the Wired excerpt. So I'd just love to hear 2 to 3 books you recommend that listeners take a look at, or even just broader that you're thinking about as a novelist and everything.
Oh man, it's always tough. I'll just tell you what I'm reading now.
Just go for it.
I just sort of read like with nothing. I'm actually looking underneath my laptop, which my two books are propped up right now. So I'm reading the Selected Poems of Frederick Seidel. I always think it's helpful to be reading poetry. I just recently finished Parade's End by Ford Madox Ford, which is sort of like a classic novel of the First World War. And I've been reading, one of the authors I've like just never read is John le Carré. So I've been like, start going through all his stuff. So that's sort of what's on. I'm kind of looking at my bookshelf. Yeah. And, you know, and I recently reread, John Keegan's The Face of Battle.
That,
just a classic. I hadn't read it. I read it probably 10 or 15 years ago. I just wanted to read it. So that's sort of what's on my nightstand.
That's a taking classic me back grad to the grad school book. Days. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I was gonna say
10 to 15 years, like, soccer year, Georgetown.
Yeah, I'm gonna be like, man, you know, von Clausewitz, Keegan. Yeah.
Well, Elliot, right, thank you so much. This is really great, and I think people are really gonna enjoy this.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Okay. Thanks for listening to the episode, guys. We really appreciate it. As Marshall said, go ahead and subscribe to the Realignment newsletter, which is linked in the show notes, or therealignment.substack.com. Lots of big announcements coming your way, especially on Thursday. Yes, Thursday, not Fridays, as usual. Go ahead and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts as it helps other people find the show. As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate it. We will see you all next week.